This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles.
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember, I'll always be
there. The new book, The Beatles, is a nearly 900-page biography of the group, based in part on hundreds of interviews with the Beatles' family members, friends, fellow performers, and colleagues. My guest is the author, Bob Spitz. He's also the author of the books Barefoot in Babylon about the Woodstock Festival and Dylan, a biography. Bob Spitz, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you want to do a Beatles book? There are hundreds of them that have already been written.
Yes, there have been close to 600 books, Terry, but I think that they were all embroidered around a story that the Beatles told their biographer, Hunter Davies, in 1967. And they did that largely to keep their wives, girlfriends, and family members from being offended by some of the facts that they didn't want to be let out. Since then, everybody has embroidered their story from that very first interview that they gave Hunter Davies. And because of that, the Beatles have told these stories so often that they themselves had forgotten what was true and what was not true. So it became this fantastic myth. And when Paul told me during an interview that I did with him that they had made up so much of this material, I felt that a real biographer ought to tackle a real biography.
So you say that the Beatles withheld a lot of facts because they didn't want their friends and family to know. What's an example of one of the stories that was not told to protect friends and family?
Well, you know, their apprenticeship in Hamburg, when they actually became the Beatles, is kind of a grimy story. Hamburg was a grimy place for them. They were in the Reeperbahn, which was a no-holds-barred little strip of community that was populated by some clubs that played rock music, brothels, a lot of male-female mud wrestling. And the Beatles worked very hard there, but the Beatles also discovered amphetamines there, and that kept them going through those very grueling days. Sometimes they played 10 to 14 hours a day with only a 15-minute break every 2 hours. They got gonorrhea there. Of course, they didn't want their wives and girlfriends to know that either. These are not crucial parts of the Beatles story, and yet that very difficult time that they spent in Hamburg working so hard to define their sound and really become a fabulous performing rock band this was part of the atmosphere that was there, and this was part of their story that they did not want known.
Brian Epstein, who managed the Beatles for many years, didn't really want the fans to know that Paul and John had girlfriends because he was afraid that this would discourage the female fans from fantasizing about Paul and John.
Yes, that's right.
And, you know, a lot has been said about John Lennon's first wife, Cynthia, and she's written about this as well, about how she had to just stay in the background and keep out of sight and so mm-hmm. on. What about Paul's girlfriend, Dot, who he nearly married? She nearly had a child. She miscarried, but his life, they came close to getting married, and they came close to becoming parents together. Has much been known about her before your book?
No, it hasn't, and it really took me quite a long time to find her. She was a very key part of the story. She came into the story at a very early time when the boys were still in Liverpool before they went to Hamburg, and was with Paul for about 2 years. And those were the 2 years in which he met John, in which George Harrison joined the band. This was before Ringo Starr joined the band. And they started writing together. So I felt I had to find her, and it was only by a stroke of luck that someone in the UK told me she was in Western Canada, and she prefers not to be identified and found there under her new married name. But she was very critical to this story because she was with them all through that time, but also a confidant of Cynthia Lennon's, and helped me set some of that story straight. Like Cynthia, Dot was pregnant and confronted Paul. And Paul decided, like John, to do the right thing and get married. And he was reluctant, but he knew that that's the way it would have to be. They talked to Paul's father. They took out a marriage license, and Paul gave Dot an engagement ring. They went so far as to have Dot be given lessons in how to prepare a house for her man by Paul's Aunt Jin. And Dot was incredibly excited about this wedding. Sadly, she miscarried, and she was gone from the equation almost within a week. Paul took that as a license for his freedom and moved on. It's kind of a sad ending to that story, and perhaps a little revealing about Paul McCartney.
Well, what did you learn about how the Beatles worked together from talking to Dot?
That they were like businessmen. They sat down at a certain point every day. John put on his glasses. They smoked like fiends. They opened their notebooks and they wrote. And nothing interfered with that. They could do this in a crowded cafe. They could do it in a bus. They could do it at a party. But they would remove themselves to a corner of the room. And very much like Rodgers and Hammerstein, they would write music in a very businesslike way. Nothing deterred them. And if anybody came and annoyed them while they were doing this, they told them in very stark language to remove themselves immediately.
One of the things I really love about the Beatles' early work, I mean, I have to say, I'm really a fan of the Beatles' like song era when they were actually writing songs and doing great harmonies, hand claps, you know.
Sure.
Did you learn anything about how they learned to harmonize with each other, about figuring out where they were harmonically with each other, John and Paul?
You know, that was as natural as it came. Paul was taught harmony by his father, Jim McCartney. Jim had played with several jazz bands in the 1930s and 1940s, and was always playing the piano in the house. And very early on, he had taught Paul and his brother Mike all the essential elements of harmony, how to sing, you know, a third above or below. And so by the time John and Paul sat down together, it was as natural as breathing. They never talked about it. They knew exactly where to go. And they went there naturally because their voices were so different.
Choose a record that you learned a lot about how it was made, things that weren't known publicly before, and tell us what happened behind the scenes.
Well, I think the greatest change that we have in music, our understanding of how pop music is made, comes with Revolver. Revolver, many people think, is still one of the greatest rock and roll records of all time. And I think, without a doubt, it's perhaps the Beatles' greatest album. Before that record, everything was created in the studio in a day or 2 days. There was a discipline in the studio that anybody making a pop record in the UK had to come in and do the entire thing right away. They dressed in suits. The boys could take a little lunch break, but they had to come back and complete everything. At the end of the day, that was the album. Revolver was completely organic. It had never happened before that way. They came into the studio with half-finished things. Feedback was never used before on a record. All kinds of strange instruments that were lying around the studio that had been used for sound effects on comedy albums, on spoken word albums, were dragged out of the closets and tried. Arrangements were put behind certain songs that George Martin had to play for them on harpsichord or piano. And what he did was give the Beatles free rein.
You want to choose a track from Revolver and talk about that specific track?
Well, the one that always amazes me is Taxman. It's the first song on the album. And the reason it amazes me is this. Before that, rock and roll to everybody was a 2.5-minute song. And the 2.5-minute song had a little bridge that started out. It had a chorus or two. what we hear on Taxman is this. We hear a coughing and somebody counting down, and then that very unusual syncopation of instruments. This song was not about cars or girls or high school. It was about being overtaxed. George Harrison hated paying tax. He thought it was unfair. In fact, when someone told him that the reason money had been taken out of the Beatles' paychecks for tax purposes, he was shocked. He had never dreamed that they would have to pay tax, and it infuriated him. And that was his pay-on to it. So Taxman was put together in a very, very organic way, and they allowed him to play some very strange lead guitar in it that no one had ever heard anybody play before. When that album first came on, it befuddled people.
Well, why don't we hear Taxman from Revolver? And my guest is Bob Spitz, author of the new nearly 900-page biography called The Beatles.
One, two, three, four. One, two.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me.
We'll talk more about the Beatles with Bob Spitz, the author of the new book, The Beatles, after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bob Spitz, and he's written a new biography of the Beatles. You know, the Beatles were one of the first bands to be known to be using, you know, marijuana and LSD, mm-hmm. and you can hear the influence of that in their music. You can see the influence of that in their album covers and so on. At about the time that he started seeing Yoko Ono, John Lennon started using heroin. Different kind of drug. Did that come between him and the other members of the band at all when they found out? And did it change him in a way that affected their relationship too?
This is one of the few areas that the Beatles have completely protected, talking about John's use of heroin. And only in a little way do they do it. Paul talks about it in his biography a little. They were horrified by it. They experimented with marijuana, of course, and then LSD. But by a few years later, LSD, they had finished with LSD. George wanted no part of it anymore, and he was perhaps its most avid practitioner. Paul experimented a couple times. Heroin was a completely different animal to them. I pretty well think that they thought that John was on the way to killing himself. He was... in turmoil. His relationship to them was in turmoil. They were the four musketeers all throughout the Beatles, and now they were coming apart at the seams. And I don't think they knew what to do with it. Luckily, John seemed to pull himself out of it, although I was told he was using heroin again, even here when he was in New York. But that soon became not a factor in his life as well.
What are the artistic differences that came between Paul and John?
I guess very early on, Paul decided that the image of the lovable mop tops that were the Beatles was something that he wanted to keep forever. He liked that. He was Mr. Entertainment, and he fit more easily into the showbiz mold of the Beatles. While John, of course, was not interested in that at all. In fact, the time that Brian Epstein put the Beatles in suits and made them bow, from that time on, John was removing himself, I think, from the Beatles, and George was as well. And that really drove them in opposite directions. I know that John wanted out much earlier than the Beatles split up, maybe 2 years before. He was finished spiritually with being a member of the Beatles. He had outgrown it. What John wanted to be was the Rolling Stones. He loved their image. They were rebellious. They were a little bit dangerous. The Beatles weren't at all dangerous. I mean, in some respect, when they appeared at their Sgt. Pepper's party, looking very withdrawn and having mustaches and long hair in a sense that we had never seen that kind of long hair before, and wearing very mod clothes, he was a little more comfortable. But John would have liked to have put on that leather jacket and been, you know, Keith Richards at some point in his life. And so they were going at cross purposes. And that really affected everything in the Beatles. There was chaos from within the group. They would snap at each other a little more. In the studio, they accused each other of trying to be more influential with George Martin, to have more of their songs, and hence more of their kind of influence of where the Beatles should go on a particular album. It got to a point where John and George didn't want to be in the same room with Paul anymore.
Why not?
Paul was very controlling.
In what way? Controlling of what?
Oh, in the recording studio. He would tell them how to play, what to play, when to play it. He would take over almost as the producer of the album. He would find a way to dictate whose songs would go where on the album. He became friends with all the engineers in the studio so that he could come in at different hours and put different sounds on all the tracks, even tracks that George and John were working on separately. And Paul would give these long-winded interviews to the press on his own as well that really annoyed George and John. They didn't want that image anymore. They didn't want to be part of it. And there was Paul again, being Mr. Charming, Mr. Outgoing, Mr. The Face of the Beatles. So I think towards the end there, things got very, very tense in the studio. At one point, George left the band, and they were going to replace him with Eric Clapton. John actually said, let him go, we'll get Clapton to play. And at another point, Ringo left the band. Ringo, who was the voice of calm through the Beatles, was a lovable, lovable guy who everybody loved. He couldn't take it anymore either. And it was chiefly because of the way Paul had taken over in the studio. They all had a hard time with it.
Well, a lot has been made over the years of how it was Yoko Ono that really drove the Beatles apart, because John was so obsessed with her and she monopolized so much of his time. How much did Yoko Ono's relationship with John actually have to do with the breakup of the band, do you think?
Well, I think it had a lot to do with it, but it had to do with it in a different way. As I said before, John had already spiritually removed himself from the band, and I think he was looking for anything that would help him make the final break. And when he met Yoko, he found it. He found someone who was strong, who was outspoken, not afraid to stand up to Paul, and could easily intimidate Paul McCartney, who I think John was intimidated by all along. And it's my belief that John used Yoko as almost a hand grenade to lob into this to blow it up once and for all. She was a very, very divisive character. I think in the Beatles anthology, they were very restrained, but you can hear George saying, and Paul saying, we didn't know what to make of her being in the studio. We had never had a woman in the studio before, let alone any guests in the studio. And here was Yoko insisting to be let in to every one of their recording sessions, and she interrupted. She would say, no, do this, do that. Beatles do this, Beatles do that. They were furious with John. And Yoko, I think, very craftily played her part, but she helped remove John from the Beatles very ably.
Bob Spitz, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Bob Spitz is the author of the new book, The Beatles. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.